Today's Monday, May 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president contradicts his national security advisor on North Korean missile tests.
He still feels good about the relationship that he has and about Chairman Kim's commitment that he made to the president.
Trump is in Japan getting the royal treatment and meeting with the country's new emperor. Also ahead, is it a catfight or all just in fun? A pop star's new song is naming names. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump Sunday played golf with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and presented a trophy to the winner of a sumo tournament, turning to personal diplomacy for the second day of a Japan visit, shadowed by tough trade talk. Trump is unhappy with Japan's large trade surplus and is considering putting high tariffs on its auto exports if a bilateral trade agreement isn't reached. The U.S. and China are also engaged in an expensive trade war that has pounded financial markets worldwide. But it was all smiles Sunday as the two leaders played golf and later watched giant sumo wrestlers on the final day of a 15-day tournament.
The Prime Minister and I talked a lot today about trade and military and various other things. I think we had a very productive day. And tomorrow, likewise, will be a very productive day.
Meanwhile, Trump and his national security advisor are publicly at odds about the seriousness of the threat currently posed by North Korea. In a Sunday morning tweet from Tokyo, Trump issued a retort to John Bolton the day before he told reporters that there was no doubt North Korea's recent test firing of short-range ballistic missiles violated a UN resolution. Bolton's remark was the first by a U.S. official describing the North Korean launches as a violation of U.N. resolutions. And Trump's tweet on North Korea caused confusion not only within the administration, but also among America's allies in the region. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders says President Trump remains convinced that Kim will move toward denuclearization.
Some of the activity that's taken place, as you can see from the president's Twitter, isn't something that's bothering the president. He still feels good about the relationship that he has and about Chairman Kim's commitment that he made to the president.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Vipin Narang, associate professor of political science at MIT and a member of MIT's security studies program, and asked who's correct, Trump or national security advisor John Bolton.
John Bolton is not incorrect. It is a violation of UN Security Council resolutions. But Trump's tweet, there's a lot going on in that tweet. In addition to responding to John Bolton, he also takes the opportunity to agree with Kim Jong-un in his characterization of Joe Biden as low IQ. And he still says that Kim is going to live up to his promises. So there's a lot to dissect in those 280 characters, none of which I think are particularly helpful to the process.
What is the most important as far as you're concerned?
For a long time, Kim Jong-un has been pretending to disarm and Trump has been basically pretending to believe him. And now we're at the point where, you know, how long can this continue? Now, it's certainly the case. So, yes, it's true that the short-range ballistic missile test violated UN Security Council resolutions. But it's also true that according to President Trump's understanding of the missile test moratorium, it didn't. The problem is Kim Jong-un is also, I think, trying or potentially approaching breaking point. He has domestic politics also to deal with. And the short-range missile test may just be kind of the beginning of a maximum pressure campaign of Kim Jong-un's own to try to get the United States to moderate its negotiating position. Now, the question is whether President Trump is willing to moderate America's negotiating position, which at Hanoi was very maximalist. It basically demanded that Kim Jong-un unilaterally surrender all of his weapons of mass destruction programs and his ballistic missile programs up front before any sanctions relief. Now, that's not what Kim Jong-un was expecting. So if President Trump says, okay, this ballistic missile test doesn't violate any of the agreements we've had in the past, but I'm still not willing to moderate the U.S. negotiating position, then Kim Jong-un may just start testing more frequently and test longer range missiles to see how long, you know, President Trump is willing to keep his head in the sand and unwilling to moderate his position. You know, I think we're entering a very precarious phase, and North Korea has very clearly indicated to the United States that there's an end-of-year deadline for the United States to come back to kind of a step-by-step phasing, you know, phase process in negotiations. And we'll see. The clock is ticking, and we'll see whether, you know, Kim Jong-un does extend or push the line on these tests, and whether Trump still continues to deny that they're provocations and or violations of the, at least the spirit of the Singapore process.
So what happens in your mind when that point is reached where they won't, the U.S. won't take anymore?
Well, so the risk is that Kim Jong-un tests one missile too many or one too far in the next coming months and Trump just flips. And we've seen that if Trump feels betrayed, he can lash out very aggressively. And there is John Bolton standing there with the only other alternative to the Hanoi and Singapore process, which is, you know, the American and North Korean approach at this point is kind of call it denuclearization by diplomacy. We know that Kim Jong-un isn't going to give up his nuclear weapons program willingly, voluntarily, but there are caps and freezes that we can possibly negotiate. But if that doesn't work and Trump says, okay, Kim has just betrayed the trust and the spirit of this process, John Bolton has advocated the only other alternative, which is denuclearization by force. And that means, you know, what Lindsey Graham has said, which is basically trying to destroy North Korea's nuclear weapons facilities and program through military action. The problem is North Korea has nuclear weapons. And, you know, the chance that a nuclear weapon goes off in the region or against the United States when you attempt a military action to get rid of them is non-trivial. And so that's the alternative. And the risk is very, very high that, you know, you end up in a military conflict that could result in a nuclear use.
In the tweet, President Trump also said that he has confidence that Kim Jong-un will keep his promise to me in moving toward denuclearization. That's just a continuation and a reinforcement, one would think, of Trump's personal diplomacy, which he thinks still works.
Right. And there's, you know, there are two ways to interpret that. One is, you know, there's the missile testing moratorium promise. The second is President Trump still insists and Secretary Pompeo still insists that Kim Jong-un promised to disarm the final fully verified denuclearization of North Korea. Secretary Pompeo said that Kim said this to his face half a dozen times. Here's the problem. North Korea and Kim Jong-un has never said that. There's no evidence that Kim Jong-un promised to unilaterally disarm. And the risk is that if President Trump really believes that, and this tweet is referring to the full disarmament process and not just the testing moratorium, then we really do have a problem, because if President Trump continues to believe that Kim Jong-un promised to disarm and will disarm, and is not just pretending to believe it, then we really have a problem, because Kim Jong-un never agreed to that. You know, I do find it ironic, you know, Trump is tweeting this from Japan, which is where the ally that is most concerned about where the process is, because when President Trump says he's not concerned about short or medium range ballistic missiles, he's sitting in Tokyo with Prime Minister Abe, who is most concerned particularly about those missile ranges. And so the irony of tweeting that from Japan, I think, shouldn't be lost on us. And also, you know, we haven't talked a lot about the fact that President Trump in this tweet decided to invoke Kim Jong-un to attack a domestic opponent. And that opens up a whole Pandora's box about, is it really appropriate for the president to appeal to the affirmation of a dictator when attacking Joe Biden, who was vice president of the United States? There was a lot going on in that tweet. That was some of the most interesting and dynamic 280 characters a president has tweeted in a while.
That's VOA Asia's I'm Ira Melman speaking with Vipin Narang, associate professor of political science at MIT. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. 30 people are dead, 200 missing after a boat sinks on a Democratic Republic of Congo lake. A Trump ally says Democrats face political peril if they pursue Trump impeachment. An 8.0 magnitude quake rocks eastern Peru. A new study finds that we are only 43% human. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. European leaders have joined voters in casting their ballots to elect a new 751-member European Union Parliament. The polling began Thursday, but 21 of the 28 member nations held elections on Sunday. About 400 million people were eligible to vote. VOA's Latika Hoke reports that the voter turnout was the highest in 20 years.
EU election officials say across the bloc, voters came out in significantly larger numbers than in the previous election in 2014. In many member states, including Germany, France, Poland, and Sweden, the turnout was estimated at more than 50%. One reason for the record turnout is concern about growing populism in Europe, said Swedish Prime Minister Stefan Löfven after casting his ballot.
We need to stand up against the far right, stand up for women's rights, for the rights of the employees. We need to make sure that the European Union lawmakers actually are for the people of the countries within it.
Opponents of immigration, such as Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, expressed hope the poll would favor parties that want to block the influx of migrants into the Union.
This is the first election after the migration crisis, which has happened in 2015. In many countries in Europe, there was no chance for the people to express their own opinion on that subject.
Populists were predicted to finish first in two big member states, Italy and Britain. Right-wing parties also did well in Austria and France, although initial projections suggested that the far-right nationalist parties had failed to make a major impact. The traditional centrist coalition that has been in power looked like it was losing ground. As a result, the EU Parliament is expected to be more fragmented than ever before. Former Polish President Lech Wałęsa, who led the 1980s revolutionary Solidarity movement, warn against growing political divisions in Europe.
There is great mistrust. We are all very divided. We're just coming out of a period of conflict, so nobody trusts anyone. It is therefore difficult to build something together, but we have no other choice. Either we'll destroy our civilization or we'll build it in an intelligent way.
President Emmanuel Macron of France, one of the EU's oldest and largest members, said the vote comes at the most perilous moment for Europe since the Second World War. Zlatica Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, there is growing uncertainty as Theresa May became the third conservative leader to fall victim to party divisions over Britain's membership of the European Union. Bowing to a party revolt and threats of mass cabinet resignations, May announced her departure, but will remain as prime minister while the Conservatives elect a new leader. Her exit throws into disarray how and when Britain will leave the EU.
Theresa May came to power in 2016 after Britain's vote to leave the European Union prompted the resignation of predecessor David Cameron. Just as Cameron had done 3 years ago, Theresa May walked out of the prime minister's residence at 10 Downing Street Friday to waiting cameras and announced her resignation, saying she bitterly regretted failing to deliver Brexit.
I believe it was right to persevere, even when the odds against success seemed high. But it is now clear to me that it is in the best interests of the country for a new Prime Minister to lead that effort.
Her voice cracking, the Prime Minister struggled to hide her emotions.
I will shortly leave the job that it has been the honour of my life to hold. The second female Prime Minister, but certainly not the last. I do so with no ill will, but with enormous and enduring gratitude to have had the opportunity to serve the country I love.
Theresa May tried 3 times to get a majority of members of Parliament to back the Brexit deal she had negotiated with Brussels, but her Conservative Party had seen enough. The party will choose a new leader after June 7th, a process that could take 2 months or more. Analyst Fabian Zulig of the European Policy Centre spoke to VOA via Skype.
The difficulty for any new leader is that the majorities in the House of Commons have not changed.
More than a dozen Conservative members of Parliament are expected to put their names forward to replace May. Most are demanding a tougher line with Brussels.
The chances that the EU will substantively reopen the withdrawal agreement are pretty much zero. Given how unpopular that deal has proven to be in the UK, I think the chance of no deal are very high.
Many leadership candidates say Britain must walk away with no deal if the EU doesn't budge, among them former Foreign Secretary and front-runner Boris Johnson. Theresa May will still be in office for President Donald Trump's state visit to Britain at the beginning of June, likely to be her final act on the global political stage. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif told journalists during a 48-hour visit to Baghdad that Iran would respond to what he called aggressive actions by the U.S., both economic and militarily, but that it continues to adhere to the 2015 nuclear accord. known as the JCPOA, Iraqi Foreign Minister Mohammed Ali Hakim insisted that Baghdad opposes U.S. sanctions against Tehran, but would be ready to act as an intermediary between both parties at the right moment. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
The 48-hour visit to Baghdad by Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif follows recent protests by supporters of Iraqi cleric Muqtada Sadr, calling for a peaceful resolution to the current escalation of tensions between the U.S. and Iran. During a press conference Sunday with his Iraqi counterpart, Zarif insisted Tehran was still abiding by the 2015 nuclear accord with the P5 plus one group of countries. But he added Tehran would respond to economic and military actions taken by Washington. He says Iran will defend itself against efforts to wage war against it, either economic or military, in order to cause damage to the Iranian people. Iran, he insists, will react with force and resistance. Zarif did not, however, specify what Iran's reaction would be. Iraqi Foreign Minister Mohammad Ali Hakim insisted Baghdad did not support what he called one-sided actions by the United States, but it is ready and willing to serve as an intermediary between Tehran and Washington if and when the need should arise. He says that Iraq opposes one-sided actions by Washington and stands by its neighbor Iran in the face of such actions, but Baghdad is ready to serve as a mediator between both parties at the appropriate moment. Iraqi Prime Minister Adel Abdel Mahdi insisted earlier in the week Baghdad is sending delegations to various capitals to push for a de-escalation in tensions. He says Iraq is talking to both the United States and Iran and will send delegations to a number of countries, including the United States and Iran, in order to push for a calming of tensions. Hakim indicated Sunday he is planning to attend the Arab summit that is expected to convene on May 30 in Mecca to discuss the crisis. Saudi King Salman has called for an Arab, an Islamic, and a Gulf summit in Mecca. Analysts on Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV suggested Baghdad has good relations with Saudi Arabia and would transmit diplomatic signals from Tehran to both Riyadh and its Gulf allies. At the same time Zarif was visiting Baghdad, Iran's deputy foreign minister Abbas Ali Araghchi was making a diplomatic trip to Oman, Kuwait, and Qatar. University of Paris political science professor Khatar Abu Diab tells VOA Iran is speaking from both sides of its mouth during the current crisis with the U.S. and the Gulf states. He says Iran is using double talk, insisting on one hand that it is seeking peaceful and balanced relations with the Gulf states, while at the same time attacking ships in the United Arab Emirates, attacking a Saudi oil pipeline, and using its Houthi, Hezbollah, and Hashd proxy militias to encircle Saudi Arabia. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
This is Science in a Minute.
As a young child, you may have been ordered to eat your broccoli because it's good for you. Well, this sage advice is actually based in science. Past studies provided evidence that broccoli and other cruciferous vegetables like cabbage, cauliflower, and Brussels sprouts may play a role in inhibiting the growth of common forms of human cancer. A new study led by Dr. Pier Paolo Pandolfi at Boston's Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center suggests that a gene called WWP1 produces an enzyme that interferes with the work of a powerful cancer-suppressing gene called PTEN. Working with mice, Dr. Pandolfi and his team found evidence that I3C, a compound found in cruciferous vegetables, can shut down the production of this enzyme that keeps PTEN from doing its job in fighting cancer. The study was published in the journal Science. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
For decades, Kenya has hosted refugees fleeing conflict, drought, and persecution in East Africa, including sexual minorities. Most gay refugees hope to resettle outside of Africa to Western countries where gay rights are better protected. But while they wait, a process that can take years, one group of gay refugees is helping inform and educate others about their situation. Raoul Ambour reports from Kasirian, Kenya.
Ugandan refugees Brian Kasali, Raymond Bryan, and Chris Waswa host weekly podcasts from a safe house in Kenya. The men tell their audience what it's like to be a refugee and to be gay, considered a crime in Uganda, punishable by life in prison.
Well, to 2009, when Uganda introduced the anti-homosexuality bill, many people left their countries to different countries like Europe. They went to Germany, you know. So for us, we just went to Kenya, just because it was the nearest country to seek refugee.
While stigma is still common, Kenya is considered the East African country most accepting of gays, where refugees can wait without fear for transfer to Western countries with laws protecting gay rights. But the process is complex and can take years, says the United Nations Refugee Agency.
It's the governments of countries around the world, whether it's Australia or Canada or the United States or others, who determine how many people they can resettle, how many people, what profile, what types of families, what types of individuals.
While waiting to leave Kenya, in 2015, a group of gay East African refugees formed the Nature Network to podcast on refugee and gay issues. Their shows are available on social media and through gay rights networks. The mainly Ugandan men earn a living by selling chicken to neighbors and local eateries.
When you're a refugee, it doesn't mean that your hands are gone. You need to work. If you can't afford living in a camp, and you can afford, because there is urban refugees, if you can afford to live an being an urban refugee, that means you have to do projects.
Kenya's High Court on Friday is set to rule on whether or not to overturn a colonial-era law against gay sex. While the gay refugees at Nature Network welcome the possibility, most say they still want to leave Africa. A change in law might help change some people's views, says Brian, but the overall hatred and discrimination will still be there. Raoul Ambour for VOA News, Kasirian, Kenya.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
VOA calendars are in. This year's calendar features a variety of scenic
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs. Programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night.
Who's the girl?
She's a princess.
Oh, aren't they all?
No, we had a connection.
Disney's live-action Aladdin is flying high with an estimated $105 million in North American sales at the box office during the four-day Memorial holiday weekend. It's the sixth highest Memorial Day weekend total ever, topping the 2011 mark of $103.4 million for The Hangover Part 2. The top total came in 2007 when Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End took in $139 million in its first 4 days. Aladdin is also dominating movie-going internationally with $121 million in 56 markets. Veterinarian Dr. Karen Lawrence has become known as Africa's pangolin doctor for leading medical efforts to help save the scaly anteaters rescued from the illegal wildlife trade to recover. Her pioneering tube feeding and blood testing is helping to improve her endangered patients' survival rate. Maurice de Klerk reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
And if you look at his feet, it's one of the ways we know how long they've been in captivity. His feet are nice and hard.
This endangered ground pangolin, one of the species found in South and Eastern Africa, is lucky. He's one of 50 pangolins rescued this year from wildlife traffickers and put in the care of veterinarian Dr. Karen Lawrence. Her groundbreaking medical care for the scaly anteaters means he's more likely to soon be back in his natural habitat.
Very little is known about the Temex ground pangolin. They've already had this poaching epidemic in Asia for quite a long time. So they've had lots of time to do research on theirs, whereas we get one at a time. Asian pangolins in captivity will eat out of a bowl. Ours do not. They have to be taken out into their natural environment and followed almost while they feed.
Dr. Lawrence's team pioneered a tube feeding method with low-fat, high-protein cat food to keep rescued pangolins alive and recovering. Her blood testing research has made it easier to tailor treatment plans for each pangolin. The director of the Center for Veterinary Wildlife Science at the University of Pretoria, Professor Leith Meyer, says Dr. Lawrence's work is far-reaching.
She's discovering really important treatments. She's discovering very important things about their normal physiology, how their normal body works, and that all allows her and will allow other people in the world to then better treat their pangolins.
Nikki Wright is with the African Pangolin Working Group and Humane Society International. She says in Africa, conserving pangolins is not just about stopping poachers.
We need all the different aspects. And at this point, the most important one is the veterinary treatment.
Pangolins receiving specialist treatment in South Africa have been doing well, says the chairperson of the African Pangolin Working Group, Professor Raymond Janssen.
If we get them early enough, our success rate is out of the hospital more than 90%. So we monitor them for up to a year following their release, and their success rate is about 75%.
Pangolins are one of the most trafficked animals. With Dr. Lawrence's help, it may just be possible to prevent this gentle creature from being completely wiped out. Marise de Klerk for VOA News, Johannesburg.
I'm nasty. Miley Cyrus is sending fans a bit of a tease about three new songs. One of them called Catitude, the other is Dream, and Mother's Daughter. And in Catitude, she mentions music divas, Nicki Minaj, and Cardi B. The two have apparently been in an ongoing feud, and in the lyrics, she sings, I love you, Nicki, but I listen to Cardi. Come and get it till I know you want some. Nashville, Tennessee, where I'm from. That does it for today's international edition, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com, and we thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. I love you, Nicki, but I listen to Cardi. I got a new song on the radio. It'll go 3, 2, 1. That's right, it's number one. And I can't take it with me as a carry-on. Honey, I got my luggage in Brazilian. My 16th birthday.
mad because your hair is flat. You're just mad because your hair is flat. Mine's not.
This is VOA News. I'm Tom.